I'm Gab. He's Jules. No, he's not. It's Nate and Manua joining us because Jules has a well-earned day off. It's gray and cloudy skies.
As
over
the usual.
You came down from Manchester.
It was sunny in Manchester, I have you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But we have a packed show for you because it's Boxing Day. So much going on. And we're going to start at the Etihad because, wow. So Manchester City play Leicester. And that first half hour, in case you were under a rock or something, City go 4-0 up. Would have been 5-0 up, that ridiculous assist that Bernardo Silva somehow, he's walking backwards. I don't know how he does it, setting up Raheem Sterling. I think even Sterling's like, right, this can't be real, right? We're going to get into what happened later because it's pretty extraordinary. But hit me. What were your thoughts of that first half hour?
It was kind of crazy. Like, obviously, this version of Leicester City at this moment is not as good as, say, years gone by.
Well, and they have a ton of injuries.
Exactly,
All three centre-backs out.
Exactly. And they tend to run City quite close in some of these games. So for that game to start and City to get the first goal after 5 minutes, you're like, oh, okay, that's a change. That's a break from the norm. And then it just went, it was another. And the way they were playing, like, you can see they're playing with supreme confidence. They've got so much quality on the field, so much quality on the bench as well. And that's what they can do. It's not something you should ever expect to see, but it's what they can do. And I'm sure for Leicester at that time, because I've been there myself, you end up looking at the clock and it's like 3-0 after 30 minutes, 4-0 after 30 minutes, 6-7-8. You're a bit concerned. But to be fair to them, they got back in the game.
I thought that was incredible because my natural instinct, I mean, as being Italian, would have been like, all right, screw this. We're 4-0 down after half an hour. We have another game coming up in 48 hours. We only have 3 substitutions in the Premier League. Fine. Let me send in, you know, some of these other guys I've never heard of on the bench. And
it's dangerous, though. That's dangerous because if you not necessarily say a sub will weaken a side, but if you try and mail it in as such, then you could be romped and it could be far bigger and everybody feels the effect of it. Well, you'd care. You would care.
See, that's
the manager
thing.
Would care. The fans would care. That's the thing. You can't come back from that.
Well, see, my approach would have been wrong. Brendan Rodgers' approach is obviously correct. Because in the second half, see, I don't know if Leicester started playing better in the second half because those are 3 counterattacking goals. Again,
yes.
I mean, newsflash, they're 4-0 up and then they score 3 goals in the space of what, 11 minutes?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And they're all counterattacking goals. I mean, the third one maybe a little less so. But and then they could have scored more. And that's really what struck me. Is it just a cliche to say City switched off?
It's not necessarily a case of switching off. But when you think about the fact that it's all about 3 points in itself, City in the second half were not going to step out with the same level of desire, say, maybe they had at the start of the game when there was something that was there. Most people would anticipate that the game's done because they can manage a game. The second half was there to be managed until
all of a sudden. But they didn't
manage it. Exactly. And to be fair to Leicester, they stayed into it. But, like, it's the Premier League. If you're at halftime and you're 4-0 down, you're going out there for the second half, you know, like, City shouldn't have been surprised that Leicester were going to do better. I think in some ways, you know, they were clinical with certain things that they did. But the second half couldn't have been the same as the first half if you're trying to say that you're a serious team in that division. So in fairness to them, they scored the first and they carried on. And at 4-3, you're like, well, I did not see this coming. But then the way the game ended is kind of what most people thought, I guess.
Again, I'm thinking of City in the second half. Again, thinking Italian, I would have said, all right, guys, 4-0 up, game's over. We can pass circles around these Muppets. Let's spend another 15 minutes, just make the pitch big, slow the game down to a crawl, just keep it forever, make them foul us. Then I'm going to send on Palmer and all those other double barrel guys, and let's conserve our energy and let's win. Pep didn't do that because otherwise they would have been caught on the counter 3 times the way they were.
Yeah, that is right. I think in an ideal world, yes, they would have been able to make tons of changes like that, but it still needed to respect the opponent for a little bit. I think if they made it to 60 minutes or 65 and it was still 4-0, maybe. But then all of a sudden at 65, it's 4-3. So as a consequence, he's got a different strategy. But it's like you were saying, in terms of momentum, the ebb and flow of a game, if you've got a 4-0 lead, you're not going to be as front foot as the team who have to try and show at least some level of pride.
Here's the thing. At 4-3, then we get the Laporte header to make it 5-3. And then there's the other chance, I can't remember if it was Iheanacho, but where, like, he shoots the ball and be like, oh, what a save from Ederson. I'm like, it's not a save. The ball just bounces off his big head.
Yeah.
If that goes in, it's 5-4. I kind of feel like all bets are off because then you get the chaos atmosphere that we sometimes see at the end of these holiday season. I mean, were you feeling that same vibe?
Yeah. Do you know, I think I was. From the moment you saw that Leicester could score 3, there was no Why would they not believe they can go and score another? You know, especially for some of those goals and the nature of it in terms of hitting them on the break or having things bounce your way and so on. So, yeah, it did feel like anything could happen. It's strange to have City playing such an, what felt like an, almost like an end-to-end type feel of a game, because that doesn't necessarily suit them. Them controlling the game, controlling possession, and like defending by keeping the ball, that's more of what they are, but it just goes to show, like, nothing's going to be taken for granted going forward.
All right. If you're Pep and you look at it, I know it's an obvious question. And what he said afterwards, he was all smiling and like, ah, what a game, blah, blah, blah. Again, I know it's a cliche, but I have to ask you, are you happier for the 6 goals scored or the 3 goals conceded? Or angrier for the 3 goals conceded?
I think deep down I'd be angry for the 3 goals conceded, because I think the City scoring 6 doesn't really surprise anyone, but City conceding 3 does. I think that makes up basically a third of the goals that conceded to this point throughout.
And they could have conceded more.
Exactly, exactly. And that type of thing there, for the nature of the goals, I think it offers encouragement for the opposition. Whereas with the 6 goals, people know that they're a good side, they'll get chances. But when you see other teams scoring against other sides, it's the same sort of feeling, I think, as when Brentford scored 3 against Liverpool, or when somebody recently scored a few against Chelsea. Like, you think to yourself, well, we can do it. Only takes one team to do something for others to sort of feel energized by that. And in the makeup of it, like for Leicester, it's catching them on the break. Another team will think, well, we can do that, but we just need to commit bodies forward. And now some of those bodies going forward will believe that they can achieve the same sort of goals as you saw with Leicester.
Okay. It's easy to say, right? Recipe, catch City on the break, because they commit a lot of people forward. I think that's what sort of de facto most teams kind of have to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you either go and you try to catch them high, like Leeds might do or whatever, and then they play through you and you're mm-hmm. defending one-on-one. Or what most teams do to some degree is you sit back and you try to get score in transition, right? That's the only way to play against City. If you're a City defender, which you once were.
Apparently I was, yeah. It was a while ago, but yeah.
I'm just curious, when you're in those situations where it's you and another guy, and both fullbacks are up, and you know that if you lose the ball, either Fernandinho or Rodri foul somebody straight away in transition, or otherwise you have people running at you. Can you just talk me through a little bit? Like, I'm assuming there's some communication between the center backs and stuff. How do you manage the space behind you?
Yeah, I think for City, one thing which I've seen from watching them is like they're very aggressive in terms of how they play. They're not shy about going 1v1 at the back and things like this. Even though the people back there aren't necessarily the quickest or the strongest, they're incredibly competitive. So in terms of how things break sometimes, I think they fancy themselves 1v1, which is fair, because I think overall they are good defenders. But one thing's for sure, like for the people who do go forward, there's certain people who remain. The 2 centre-backs and the 6 will tend to be there. And that 3 tend to be able to stifle most attacks that people try and bring upon them. But to give Leicester credit, they'll throw in 3 bodies forward, sometimes 4 bodies forward on the counter, which is actually quite rare, I feel, because for most sides, you want to drop back and then try and hit on the break. Like I watched Wolves do it the other day, and balls are coming in the box, and you saw like Jimenez only before he got sent off. There was no one else really trying to do it in there. So it's almost like there's a lack, not a lack of belief as such, but it's a good thing in theory, but then for others, they find it hard to do in practice. So for a centre-back at City, it's just about sort of limiting mistakes, isn't it? And I think if you can be good individually, but if you do it well as a collective with the other centre-backs and whoever, and the 6, then you can be quite solid. Because at worst, you can slow down the people who are maybe trying to come on the break, but you know that the people in your team have been tasked with running back as well. And in fairness to City, they do that. So it's just a case of buying time, and I think they're quite good at that overall.
Well, I would have said at worst, you concede a goal or get yourself
these are things that also could happen. But yeah, in terms
of
strategy.
You're thinking positive.
I'm thinking, trying to be positive. You know, it's Christmas. I'm trying to be positive. Right. Come on.
I speak to Ferran Torres because obviously the story broke. We're going to talk later about how Barcelona may or may not afford it. I think there's still a lot of stuff that we don't know. But just purely from the City perspective, I touched upon this with Jules the other day, but I'm looking at the numbers, right? City obviously have a very deep squad in terms of talent, but you know, the numbers still are what they are. There is a 25-man squad in the Premier League. Obviously, Benjamin Mendy's not there, so you're down one there. And now with Ferran Torres going as well, you know, we hear stories of City's academy, but so far this season, the only one who's played any sort of semi-significant first team minutes is Cole Palmer. I take it as read that Ferran Torres is really going to move in January. If Pep really believes that Barcelona are somehow going to be able to register him in January, doesn't that imply that he's going to bring in another body? Why would you leave yourself a man down? Especially if you're willing, as we saw, to go and put Grealish and Foden on the naughty step from time to time.
I think in some ways that naughty step situation does show the depth that they have, because for Grealish being a £100 million player and for Foden being one of the best players in that team and in the league, the fact that they can drop those two and still go out and be winning games does show that they do have depth there. This is with other players missing as well. So I don't know. I don't think they'll bring somebody in. I don't think, but I'm not sure, because this move almost feels like, I don't know, I could be wrong, but it feels like an emotional one for Torres himself. Because he's a young player, like he's 21 years of age, I think he is.
21, 22, yeah, he's there.
If that, so he is young. And the time he spent in Manchester and in England has been during the pandemic, essentially. And you kind of wonder, has he fully settled into life here? And the thing that he settled into, is it what he was hoping it would be? Especially to not be playing week in, week out. So even though Barcelona are in a very interesting situation in terms of their history right now, I'm guessing for a Spaniard, a young Spaniard playing abroad, the chance to go and be playing for that club is still quite significant. Anyway.
I get why Torres would want to go back to Spain. But I don't. Barcelona, Manchester.
I know what you're saying.
No, but from City's perspective, right? If you were City, if you were Cheeky, right? Do you think we're now down a body? I know he's been injured, but obviously it's better to have your full complement of options because you don't know what's going to happen. Kevin De Bruyne's injury record isn't great. If somebody else breaks down, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
Grealish
decides to go and like...
I know what you're saying, when you think about the role...
So you wouldn't bring somebody else in.
I think when you think about the role that Ferran Torres has had for Man City this season so far, like he started the first few games, so that's because so many people weren't ready to be
playing. And scored a ton of goals.
Yeah, I agree, but lots of people weren't ready at that time. I think when you look at it now, the role that he has is somebody who can play, not necessarily somebody who does play. And for a can play, would you go out in January to find somebody who can play, or would you hope that maybe Cole Palmer would be able to step up and essentially be able to be that extra body in there at that time? Because Ferran Torres at the moment, for City, in my opinion, isn't a go-to starter. And I think if everybody was available, he might not be second choice in most positions.
Yeah, I disagree. I think it's an absolute no-brainer.
So bring someone in?
Yeah, no question.
Like who?
I think what you would do is, obviously, if you're at City, the collective is super important, right?
Yes.
So if we believe that they were going to sign Harry Kane in the summer, you necessarily perhaps imperil the collective for a minute. Because the Cristiano Ronaldo thing, I think we know that that's kind of jump, you know.
Yeah.
We know it wasn't really going to happen.
Yeah.
So you upset the collective, or you risk upsetting the collective by bringing in a superstar player, if he's a superstar player, on superstar wages and so on, and you say, all right, I'm going to readjust to accommodate Harry Kane, and maybe Harry Kane would have fit or not. I don't think at this stage of the season, you know, they're going to move for a superstar. I do think it makes sense to bring in an option, maybe a young guy, maybe somebody who you can bring along slowly, give them those 6 months.
Sounds like you've got someone in mind here. Who's this?
Well, no, I mean, all right. Vlahovic is obviously on the market in January. Yeah. I don't know if he would fit or not. And he would be expensive and there would be more expectation with him. And maybe Vlahovic might just be disruptive enough that you don't want to do that. But if you bring in, you know, the guy Okafor at Salzburg, for example, I've seen him play. I've seen this guy play for Switzerland as well. We saw him in the Champions League, right? He's a winger, works his rear end off. He's 20 years old or whatever, however old he is. He can finish, you know. You just bring him in and he just sits and he watches Mahrez play and these other guys play or whatever. If you think a guy with that profile who is not going to cost you $100 million, who you can bring in and worst comes to worst, he learns under Pep, he's part of a successful system. I mean, they're reselling Ferran Torres as a profit, right?
Yeah.
And then you have a body.
Just in case.
And in his case, it's somebody with international experience, if it is Okafor. I mean, I'm not breaking news here. I'm just using him as an example.
Well, sounds like you're breaking news. But
no.
I know he's
but what I'm saying is there are a lot of talented young attacking players that you can bring in.
I agree.
Because you've worked so hard. You only have so many years of Pep. And you still have a window of opportunity with this team that's going to close at some point. you have the money, you have the opportunity, you've just banked this money. Well, you know, if the Torres deal happens, of course.
Yes, of course.
Why would you not do that to have that other option, even if it's somebody you bring along slowly?
Do you think they bring somebody in July?
No, I think I would do it January, simply to address the fact that you're two players down.
But the point I was trying to make is if certain players who are supposed to be available in the summer become available and they do bring them in, is that going to be as well as this person in January? Because then they've got two extra bodies, and say, if we're talking about attackers, then does that mean the squad's now too big again?
I don't think so because, again, you know, when they, this team has a very clear policy, right? When they extended De Bruyne's contract, they didn't do the Aubameyang thing. We're like, oh yeah, let's give you like a monster deal. They extended it by 2 years, right? Yeah. So I think they are being careful and they are being quite responsible. No, you can always bring somebody in and then you loan them out elsewhere. I mean,
yeah, I see what you're saying. You've brought me along. I understand where you're coming from. But I'd worry about how many games are going to. No, I'd worry about how many games are going to play though.
Remember Brahim Diaz?
Yeah.
Right. To me, that's a great example. Right. A very talented young player who was there. He was a body. He was part of the squad. At one point, it was Diaz and Foden breaking into the first team. Right. Yeah. It didn't work out. He did not become a regular at Manchester City. All right, fine. So he went to Real Madrid. Didn't make an impact there. Now he's at Milan. He is having an impact. He's a bit older. He's matured. You know, there is a value in these players as well. And you can also, you know, get your, you're not going to lose money off it. I don't. To me, it seems like a no-brainer.
If maybe it would be an idea to bring in a young player that's based in Britain then. Because I think it's a big move for somebody from elsewhere to come in. And to come in from a place where they've been playing to then arrive in a place where they're kind of going to be
because you wanted to sign Bukayo Saka. I know that. But, you know, just I don't think that's going to happen.
Not in January anyway.
It's a word on Leicester, because this was a season when obviously they spent a lot of money. They had a deep squad. This was a season when a lot of us said, man, maybe they could upset the apple cart and finish top four and kick on, because, you know, most of us felt there's three outstanding teams. And then, you know, United, Solskjaer, Conte, Nuno, whatever. It didn't happen, I think, largely through injuries.
Yeah.
Right. And so we give Rodgers a pass. There's only so much you can do, right?
Yes and no. I think logically speaking, you say you do want to give the pass. But then also, it doesn't feel right to just write off a whole season. You know, maybe a period of time, maybe a couple of weeks or something. But at some point, if you've got a deep squad, surely the fact that you now have to use it, you should be able to find a way to be more successful with it. I think for him, I think he believes in himself, and as a consequence, the squad that he has, even though it's not his best squad in his opinion, I would still say that if you asked him how he's done this year, I think he'd say they've underperformed. And I think that's the key element there, because in some ways, you look at them, they're in mid-table, maybe a bit lower, and they always feel like they could do something, and they have done something. Like, I think they beat United and stuff like that, but they haven't done it consistently enough, and it's at a time now where you've got a top three who are doing what they're doing. Then you've got a battle for fourth between West Ham, Arsenal, Spurs, and Manchester United currently. So you needed to be almost at your best to be part of that race in itself. And so for you to be off the pace just that little bit, like it feels like it's going to be a long way for them to catch up. But I don't know, it's tough to give someone a complete pass because injuries are injuries. It's not like he's playing 10 academy players every week.
No, when they're all in the same position. And I think the other thing, which in Brendan's defense, I think derailed him a little bit, is this, right, Tielemans was terrible, I thought, against City. I mean, terrible compared to the Tielemans level. For me, Yuri Tielemans, if he's not the best midfielder, best all-around midfielder in the Premier League, he's, for me at least, in the top 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, it's really good, yeah.
Any way you slice it. He has this contractual issue, which isn't going away. And for Leicester, it's really, really difficult. Because
is this his final year?
I think he's got 18 months left.
Okay.
But you know that if he doesn't put pen to paper, you got to sell.
Mm.
And you know people are going to line up for Yuri Tielemans because I think he's so far ahead of so many others of his same age profile. He's got the experience. He's got the quality.
Yeah.
Premier League proven. I'm not saying that this is why he had a poor game and why maybe he's had ups and downs this season because he was outstanding early in the year. But when you're Tielemans and you look around and you're saying, man, I got this contract saying – everybody around me is getting injured. Look at the back. I see, you know, poor Daniel Amarchi back there.
Yeah.
You know, I got Albrighton playing right back. You know.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think it's fair because, like, there's the other side of this coin, for example, would be, say, someone like Declan Rice, who apparently is coveted by tons of teams and players, and tons of players or whatever, clubs rather. But he's at West Ham, and West Ham are doing well, and he's the captain for them. So staying is going to be a far easier decision than, say, being somewhere where essentially you're going to feel like you're sort of trending downwards, even though there are injuries and so on. Because you almost get a feel of like, well, this is what they're getting over here, but this is here. Like, is this really my situation if I could get more, if I could do more somewhere else? So it is an interesting time, and he's very good, as you say. I'm glad you've given him some recognition like that, because he is very, very good.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot then. Yeah. Who's better, Tielemans? Who'd you rather have, Tielemans or Declan Rice? At your team, at City. City needs to side now. I'm just kidding.
Obvious style of play, like, I'm not saying one's better than the other, but for style of play, I think Tielemans fits into City more than Rice does. But
are you seeing him in the Rodri role, or are you seeing him in the Gundogan role?
More, I'd say more like a Gundogan, to be honest. Yeah.
He's got that. He's got that.
But then this, like, it's because, like, Rice can do the six, but then he can move around as well. But yeah. City, in terms of central midfielders, they're more pass and play as opposed to driving the ball, and Declan Rice is very good at that. So that strength would be kind of taken away from him, which isn't really the benefit, is it?
See, like, two phenomenal players. We don't just talk about big six teams.
There you go.
Final point on this, just because it is Pep. I'm curious. I think, like, because he said this just before the Christmas holiday, it kind of went under the radar. But when he said, we play too much football, they're not going to stop, they have no concern for player welfare, it would take something like a strike, but it's never going to happen.
Mm.
I just want to ask you, because there's been a change in the players' union. There's, after many years, there's no more Gordon Taylor. So many news in there. As a former union member of two different unions, because you're an MLS
union. That's a fact.
Is this something, because the first instinct is, well, Pep, the reason you get paid so much is because, you know, you play so much, right? That's natural instinct, and nobody feels sympathy for players. I'm just curious, though, do you, because I kind of feel labor hasn't really flexed the way they could have flexed towards management. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Despite the high wages and everything. What's your take? I mean,
I think Pep is right. He's off the back of what Jordan Henderson said last week as well. And from a union standpoint, I had one or two issues with the union during my time. And it was because, like, here's the not almost ironic point behind it, but for me, when I was one of the players, the people who I could go and speak to, they were obviously ex-players as well, but most of the people who were in their age group are also ex-players, are the managers and stuff for football clubs. So if I had an issue with a manager, it was, I remember, there was one point where one player I felt was being bullied, and I thought it wasn't right, and they were saying he was too fat, his body fat percentage was too high. So he had to. He was by himself. He was basically just being treated very differently. But I knew in the same time there was another. Pardon?
Neil Ruddock.
Not quite. But I knew there was another player who had the same body fat who was being allowed to train with the team. So I went to the union and say, well, this can't be right. Something needs to be done. And then the guy was like, yeah, well, you know, I can kind of see where the manager's coming from.
I know whose voice you're imitating now, so I won't.
I was like, no, this isn't a thing. So there were times, unfortunately for me, where I don't think they really click into that. And as the way football goes, so we played traditionally played 26th, 28th, like the first weekend of January and all that stuff. You just ask the question, why do you need to play on the 26th and 28th? Nobody has the answer apart from it's tradition. So I said, well, who started the tradition? Nobody knows the answer. Who wants to play 26th, 28th? You wouldn't find a yes from the players. You wouldn't find a yes from the management. You find a yes from the clubs. So who's really the people that are pushing it? Nobody knows. But unfortunately, whenever tradition comes into it, there are tons of people that never want to question it and just want to take part in it. So it's like, oh, yeah, it's Christmas. Yeah. It's supposed to be hard.
Why? So, well, the reason it all started is because everybody was off work. And back in the day when not every top flight game in England was a sellout, like, they would get massive crowds, right? Which they would normally get, because you'd have situations where, you know, Stamford Bridge, which today holds 42,000 people, their record crowd is like 105,000 in Boxing Day because they cram them all in. So that was the original.
For the 26th?
For the 26th, yeah, or for New Year's, right?
Okay.
Then it became a case of now it's obviously a case of television, right? Because you can spread everything out, right? I mean, the midweek round this week is, you know, we're playing Tuesday, Wednesday, or Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. And that is kind of what keeps the beast fed, so to speak. Mm. I think the difficult thing with a strike is ultimately, if you're going to play less, right, then...
So we're only talking one game less, by the way. Just not the game on the 28th after playing the 26th.
Right, but you mean you're moving then something else.
Potentially.
Right? And then there's only so many midweeks, and then like, ultimately, for me at least, logical solution. I said this before. I'm gonna find a way to drop this in every show. Go to 16 teams, eliminate all midweek football, eliminate the League Cup, and monetize the game. Just from a business perspective, monetize the games that you have better. And at the same time, those teams that want to play more, because it's a different story in the Football League, right? Because they make most of their money from the gates. Not just the Football League, but like, you know, Brighton. Yeah, they play 38 games and a couple cup games each year, right? They want to play more. Have a provision. If they want to set up their own competitions, if they want to set up friendly.
They
can go and do that.
You say Brighton, but when you say Brighton, like, who do you mean by Brighton? Who wants to play more? Who's Brighton? Which person? Which people? He's talking about the players, the staff.
I would imagine players at Brighton, right? Brighton have a 25-man squad. Well, if they don't want to play more, then screw them.
No, but it's not more. It's not more because it's 38 games regardless. It's the timing of the 38 games. And the big issue is the fact that you play two games in 3 days. That's the issue in and of itself. Like, this time is busier or whatever, but it's just those two games in 3 days. Even if you've moved it, flexed it a day, possibly two, there'd be far fewer complaints because then it feels more like a normal type situation. But it's the fact you play one game on a Saturday. Like, I think Arsenal played late on Sunday. Late on Sunday, and they're going to play early on Tuesday. And you're thinking, well, what's that about? You know, like, I get this, there's a game that's on TV, but still, like, it's maybe the product would be better if there was another day.
No, I think there's more creative ways that they can deal with it. And look, I'm encouraged by the fact that PFA has a new boss, Maheta Molongo.
I'm sure he'll do a great job.
I'm saying is he's different than the guy before.
I'm sure he'll do a great job, but just so you're aware, one of the issues with the union is that it's sometimes full of people who don't want things to change. And that's not just board level, that's player pool as well.
There you have it from somebody who's actually part of the Footballers Union, unlike me. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Enough City, Nadim. Let's talk Chelsea. They hadn't scored from open play I figured this out. What's that? Halftime away to Villa. It's 1-1. They hadn't scored from open play in something like 250-odd minutes, which for a big club in the Premier League is an eternity. Mm-hmm. No Havertz, no Werner. Pulisic is playing up front and running into, you know, it felt like Tyrone Mings was like stomping on him every time he was close. So Tuchel does the obvious thing. Sends on the big man, Romelu Lukaku, coming off injury, hadn't scored since mid-October. And is it too simple to say Lukaku turned the game?
No, I don't think it is at all. I think when you look back, you see his goals, you see his impact of winning the second penalty, wasn't it? It was the second one.
Yeah, second penalty.
you could see that for the Villa centre-backs, they had to play against somebody differently. I think at times, maybe they were suited to playing against like a Pulisic, because for as good as he is, you know, they can make it more physical. But with Lukaku, what's, you can't try and make it physical. It's, you're just playing into his hands. And you saw that a few times. I think he rolled Mings, the way he won that penalty. Like when the ball got played over the top, and I saw Matt Target versus Romelu Lukaku, I was like, I feel like I've seen this before. Even though I'd never seen it, I felt like I'd seen this before. And lo and behold, it ended up leading to that. So it gave Chelsea a different dimension for this particular game, because there were times as well where, say, Mount play a ball to him, post up, try and create a chance off the back of it. And I think in certain instances, like, that is key. And I think for Villa, they were comfortable in terms of defending against Chelsea in that first half. But in the second half, you just have to think differently. And yeah, when he came on, I think I would have to say he was a key difference.
Thomas Tuchel still pointing out that with the injuries that he's had and the COVID and this and that, he seemed like a very unhappy man. And I think the reason he's unhappy is that he feels like he doesn't have time to work with his players and build up that chemistry that I think Chelsea really need. Because it was one thing when he was successful at Paris Saint-Germain, where he sorted out the defense, they didn't concede goals, and then he let kind of Neymar and Mbappe freelance and riff at the other end. Chelsea don't have a Neymar and Mbappe. They need patterns of play. They need the stuff that Tuchel is good at.
Yeah.
And he's not able to deliver it because he can't work with them because they keep getting hurt.
Yeah, that's true. But is that not part and parcel of being a professional manager? Like at the highest
level. He doesn't
level?
Mean you have to be happy about it.
Exactly. He can be unhappy as he wants to be, but you know, at some points it's probably happened to everyone. And I think he's adapting, and I think that's good. But one thing I would say is that most of the sort of real tactical understanding type work that he's had with Chelsea over the year that he's been there would have come in the summer. You'd imagine. Or say just at the turn when the season was just beginning. So at this stage, maybe it's the fine-tuning thing that he's unhappy about, but they're still a very, very good side and they're still playing his image. Because when I see them play, it's very rarely do I see them play and say, well, that surprised me. I didn't know they did that. I didn't know they did this. I think people still understand their roles. And yeah, he does want more time. But I think the bigger thing is just having all his players available, because then he can have more choices to make and sort of be able to handle the side of things where Kante's just coming back. So we don't want to play him for a couple of weeks.
He's injured again now.
Well, there you go. I'm sure that's something else that really frustrated him. But it's just the nature of football. And unfortunately, when things go wrong, you know, you're not going to be happy, are you?
I think one of the difficult things is I think central midfield is really important to him. And the reality is he's got a ton of options. But Jorginho, Kante, Loftus-Cheek, Kovacic, Salah on a good day, they're all so different. And when one of them is missing, when you're not playing Jorginho and Kante together, Jorginho and Kovacic, everything changes.
Yeah.
Everything changes because you can't ask people to go and do things that they're not equipped to do.
That's exactly right, yeah.
A word on Villa, Steven Gerrard was out. It was so nice to see my old buddy Gary Mack in there. Mm-hmm. Where do you see them? Because I thought they were really good players. And I really liked Dean Smith and I felt bad when he left. But then boom, Gerrard's given them more energy. There's a lot of quality in this team. Obviously, you know, you don't necessarily expect them to get a result against Chelsea, but it's a good time to add, yeah?
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. I think under Dean Smith, it felt like they were going the wrong direction. I think they lost six games in a row. And whatever work you've done beforehand in terms of gaining the respect of a crowd and so on, like six games in a row to lose is still something. It's very much something because it's not necessarily even a feat that happens for the team. We were bottom of the Premier League. So they felt like they were trending downwards. And then when Gerrardi came in, I think he's won a couple of games. The energy's there. And, you know, that's what fans want to see. You want to see that type of bounce. But I think for Gerrard, the sort of measure of him will be what he's like long term. Because even in the game yesterday, if we were to have that as a theory for, say, the future, the first half I thought they looked really good. Then when it went to 1-1, I didn't think the performance was the same, even though most of the parameters were. So I think he'd probably be looking to that, wondering why that was the case.
Jules keeps telling us Ollie Watkins is wanted by a lot of big clubs. So watch this space, Villa fans and Arsenal fans too. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the Did we just hit $1 million stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify is your no excuses business partner. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/gabjules. All right, enough Chelsea. How about some quick hits instead?
Well, as a wise man once said, let's go, Gab.
Oh, very nicely done. Let's get the pandemic blues out of the way. Three games postponed on Boxing Day. Arsenal Wolves, Leeds Villa also postponed as we record. There could be more. Nathan, there's a lot of fixture congestion on its way.
Yeah, there certainly is. And it's funny because this time is always filled with fixture congestion anyway. So the fact that they're now going to have to knock it back, there are going to be a few very unhappy teams later on in the season. And speaking of which, we've also had Pep Guardiola talking about a strike. And Thomas Tuchel is another one who complains that the powers that be don't care about player welfare. Starting with the fact that the Premier League don't have five substitutions. Gab, does he have a point?
He looks so unhappy. Did you see that? Like, oh, and it's men in rooms behind a table and they don't care. They just don't care. This five substitution thing really bugs him. I think about this endlessly. People say, oh, no, we don't have five substitutions in the Premier League, only league in Europe not to have it. Because if we did, then it would favor the bigger teams over the smaller teams. Mm. Again, there is a lot
subjective,
of...
Subjective, that, isn't it?
Well, you know what? It's subjective. It doesn't need to be. You could do a proper analysis and see, is this actually the case? I think empirical evidence elsewhere suggests that it's not the case because what really matters isn't the quality of people on the bench. Mm-hmm. It's a difference in quality between the starters and the people who come off the bench and the impact of having people who are fit and rested on the bench. Yes, but sir. Whatever. I think Tuchel's barking up the wrong tree. He needs to persuade 14 of 20 teams. I don't think it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Arsenal romped a 5-0 win away to Norwich as Bukayo Saka scores two. Nathan, Arteta simply said Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang wasn't selected. Is he pushing his luck a little bit or do they really not need him?
I think it's a reach to say they don't need him because very quickly things can go wrong. We've seen that so much in recent weeks with teams who've had 2, 3, 4, 5 players down. And who knows, that could be Arsenal. And it's not like they're really that heavy in the sort of attacker department. So I think he's trying to make a point, but he's a very, very brave man to be making such a big point consistently. But for now, while they're winning, I suppose.
And for so long, too.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, let's talk about the other side in North London. So Tottenham beat Palace 3-0 as Lucas Moura scored a header worthy of one Alan Shearer. And Gab, that makes it 14 points of a possible 18 for Antonio Conte.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty good for him. Yeah, no, and he's up there and he's got all the games in hand. And he's really grumpy because he doesn't have enough time. He hasn't had enough time to do his double sessions. So all he can really hope for is really kind of teach on the fly, mm-hmm. Which is what he's all about, while getting the results. And they're getting the results. A lot will depend, obviously, on how they do with their games in hand. Sticking with that game, Wilfried Zaha got himself sent off for two yellow cards. Nathan, help me understand the second one where he reacts, he has a hissy fit. He's 29. He's not a child, yeah?
Yeah, it's not even the fact he's 29. It's just the fact he's played more than one game at that level and watched many games at that level because you yourself, who hasn't played at that level, knows that's not something to do at that level. Would you agree?
Maybe he was channeling his inner Jules Koundé.
Well, yeah, that also didn't go very well either, did it? But yeah, people certainly can be emotional. But I think it's a big error because the moment you're on a yellow card in a game, you play a different game. So for him to do that, you know, there's not going to be much sympathy for him at all. But anyway, moving on. So the Confederation of African Football has announced that as a gesture of goodwill, they'll be allowing clubs to not release players until January 3rd instead of December 27th. Gab, the African Cup of Nations starts on January 9th. This is bound to have an effect, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to make for a crappier tournament because people only have 4 or 5 days to prepare before the tournament starts. They call it a gesture of goodwill. I think it's more to do with the fact that a lot of clubs went to FAs and said, hey, don't call up so-and-so until this day because we need him.
Yes.
And because you've got a bunch of rich clubs and you got a bunch of FAs who don't quite have as much money, a lot of them caved and said, oh, yeah, that's fine. You can keep player X, Y, and Z. I'm not going to name names here. Look, there's no two ways about this. They knew when the tournament was scheduled. It is what it is. I think when the players are out there, they'll hopefully be galvanized and they'll produce, and we as viewers will enjoy it.
Yes.
It's suboptimal. I don't like to see big, wealthy European clubs bullying the rest of the world just because they can.
Agreed.
Sticking with the Cup of Nations, Bild in Germany are reporting that none other than Samuel Eto'o is trying to persuade Borussia Dortmund starlet Youssoufa Moukoko to represent Cameroon instead of Germany. Needham, you played for England at under 21 level.
Yes.
But you're on the record, according to your Wikipedia page, said that you would have loved to play for Nigeria at a World Cup. So, I'm assuming you can relate a little bit to Moukoko. Moukoko was born in Cameroon,
yes.
Moved to Germany when he was 10.
Yes. Yeah, I can relate to that one. And it's interesting because for him, he's obviously got his roots in Cameroon, you know, especially being born there, living 10 years there. It's like he spent more of his life in Cameroon than he has in Germany. But the fact is he lives in Germany. He's very much a part of that culture. He's a part of that league. And it's easier to understand and quantify what it is to play for that national team because he sees it on a day-to-day basis. Whereas for the Cameroon, it's a bit different. I was a victim of that in some ways. But the fact is, to be coveted by both is huge. And whatever choice he makes, it won't change his identity. But from a footballing standpoint, I'm sure he'll make the right call for himself.
Do you regret making the choice you made?
Not regret as such, no. I don't regret it because I wasn't begging to play for England. And it just so happened that Nigeria thought that I was. So they didn't call me. So in some ways, the decision was very much taken out of my hands. But anyway, reports in Spain suggest Barcelona are set to unveil Ferran Torres as early as Tuesday, Gab. And it's not clear how they can register him given the wage restrictions in Spain.
Yeah, it's a spending restrictions, more like a combination of wage and amortization and commissions. Yeah, nobody understands this. Nobody understands it.
The Spanish somebody has to somewhere.
I think there's somebody up their sleeve that they hope to sell for a lot of money, as I understand it. They're saving some money on Aguero. There's a lot of people that they need to shift somehow or get off their books for this to happen. Or, you know, maybe the deal's in place, but it happens in the summer. Maybe it's a loan with an obligation to buy. I don't know. I'm really curious to see how they pull this off. Ralf Rangnick, see how I went German there, has talked about the importance of intensity and pressing in his 4-2-2-2 system, but has lamented the fact that COVID outbreak gives him less time to work with the players. So he said he had to speak to them, 16 or 17 of them, over the phone, and not quite the same thing.
Absolutely not quite the same thing at all, but I don't think it's a case of a hard luck story for Man United because it's happening to everybody up and down the league. So if they're seeking sympathy and, you know, the product can't be right because of this, that's what everybody's saying. But at this point here, you make do. These are the circumstances. You deal with it, you get the results, and then when the time is right, you can maybe instill that plan that you want to put in right now. And back to Barcelona, just one more time. Ousmane Dembele's contract is up in June, and the club would like him to sign a new long-term deal, but with a pay cut. Is that a smart move, Gab?
It's a smart move for Barcelona. It's not a smart move for him, I think. You got 6 months. Just wait and see. Play it out. Do you want to stick around? You prove your fitness? Why not? Manchester United have told Anthony Martial he can leave, but only if the conditions are right. Plenty of reports thinking with Sevilla. Nadim, another Monchi masterpiece in the making?
It looks like it could be, because the moment I saw that, I pictured him in that shirt and I could see him doing well for them. And I think while you're at a place like Manchester United, for example, where you're not playing, you're not favoured, you've got to go and try and find some football somewhere. And I'll be honest, Manchester's nice. Perhaps Seville's nicer. Get yourself over there and see what it's like.
Not the only club we're after him.
No, exactly, yeah. So we'll see how that goes. And finally, Bayern continue to be linked with River Plate starlet Julian Alvarez. Gab, they say he's the most exciting young player in Argentina.
Yeah, he is. He's already played for the national team. He's a winger, forward type, if you haven't seen him. Not the biggest, 21 years old. The way this has been so public with Bayern makes me think either Bayern really, really want him, or his agents are very happy for the news to get out there so that other people have to come out in the open with offers. But certainly somebody who I think we're going to see in Europe very soon.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
John Terry is reportedly close to returning to Chelsea as part of their academy setup. Nadim, your thoughts, and bear in mind for those who don't know, you had a front row seat. Mm-hmm. I actually looked this up on the internet when he had his row with Wayne Bridge and the handshake that wasn't at Stamford Bridge. You were on the bench. Didn't come on. Do you remember the score that day?
It was 4-1 to City, wasn't it?
4-2.
Sorry. I'm trying to erase history.
Does this stuff matter 10 years later? Personal relationships, so on?
I think looking back to that moment, he had a lot of support from Chelsea fans, Chelsea staff, Chelsea players. So if it didn't matter then, it definitely won't matter now. There's been so much that's gone on since that time. You know, I'm sure he's going to try and move on from that. And I doubt if he gets back there, it's going to be a talking point because he still commands a lot of respect. So I think he was still captain for many years after that. And he's still a beloved figure there. I'm sure they still probably sing for him now. So 10 years on, I still can't believe that's 10 years, by the way. But yeah, that's insane. But I remember I was sitting on the bench, as I say, and this was the build-up. All the talk was, will it happen before the game? That's all the talk. I was watching the TV shows beforehand. Will it happen? The game was on TV. And I sat down and they could hear the crowd like, ooh. And then there it was, the snow. And I was like, okay,
cool. Did you know in the dress? Because you were in the dressing
room. We knew Bridgie wasn't going to shake his hand yet.
So you knew he was going to do that?
I knew Bridgie wasn't going to shake his
hand. So the question was whether Terry was going to hold his hand.
Yeah, to be fair, I knew Bridgie said he wasn't going to. I think Craig Bellamy didn't do it either. And to be fair, Bridgie's a good guy, so we supported him. Yeah. And I'm sure if I was out on the field, maybe I'd have given him one of those little like false handshakes as well. But yeah, it was. It's crazy to think that's how long that was, but I think that's also significant because he was still very much respected then. And I'm sure him coming back to Chelsea is part of his dream. He'll make that very clear. And I'm sure they'll be happy to have one of their own back. But anyway, Marcelo Brozovic is out of contract in June. And plenty of reports in Italy say Inter are hoping he'll agree an extension and a big salary bump. Your thoughts, Gab?
I have to be consistent here. The man, he's very good last year. I think he's been even better this year. I think he gets on great with Inzaghi. Inzaghi's really freed the bras to do his thing. but he picked up the paper this morning and they're saying they want to give him Lautaro Martinez type money, which, you know, it's a little over 200 grand a week if you think in pounds weekly. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking to myself, wait a minute. You're in a disastrous financial position. The man is 30 years old. The man turns 30 years old in, I think it's in April or November or something. It means that you're going to have a guy with a high salary who you can't sell on.
Yeah.
It's not a good situation to be in. I mean, unless that you can do it and, you know, he'll take a 1-year or 2-year extension and then you deal with it. I think you have to get hard line about this. You have to understand this.
Is that a sort of feel of how contracts are done in Italy, though? Do they have the 1 year, 2 years from the age of 30, or is it something that happens just a bit
like the
later?
Old Arsenal deals where you only got 1 year?
Yeah, from the moment you hit that point. Is that
no,
like something to be expected?
And I think people have to learn to be more disciplined. I mean, look, even Manchester City, when Kevin De Bruyne showed up and says, oh, look at me, I'm Kevin De Bruyne, I'm the most talented player in the Premier League, and you've got all the money in the world, they're like, that's great, Kevin. Take 2 years and like it.
Yeah.
You know, if City have to do it, other clubs have to learn that in the current climate, this is what you need to do, especially if you're injured in their financial situation. Liverpool Echo report that Jurgen Klopp is taking a long, hard look at West Ham's Jared Bowen and Leeds' Rafinha as a sort of plan B if they can't extend enough of their three forwards. So, lest we forget, Sadio Mane, Mohamed Salah, and Roberto Firmino all out of contract in June 2023. Needham, are you a fan of these guys? Can they make the step up?
So one thing which I've learned over time with Liverpool is to never judge, because in somebody like Andy Robertson, I played against him when he was at Hull and I thought he was a good player. I didn't think he'd be the Andy Robertson that's been at Liverpool for the last however many years and it's been incredible. As somebody, again, who played against Jota. I played against Jota in the Championship and I thought, oh, this guy's really good. You know, he shouldn't be in the Championship. Did I think that at this moment he'd be the second top scorer in the Premier League? Probably not. So with that being said, I have to say that for Liverpool, they've got a certain scouting network, and if they believe that these are the types of players that fit the profile that are required for Liverpool, then I'm always going to be a little bit reluctant to tell them that they're wrong, because they've gotten quite a few right over the years. Obviously, they're not perfect. Nobody's perfect.
Okay, but what is your view? Have you seen enough of Rafinha, of a fit Rafinha?
For me, in terms of style of play, I could see Rafinha fitting into the front three more than Bowen, but that's not to say that Bowen couldn't do it. I think Rafinha's really good. I think when it seems like it's been a massive coup for Leeds to have him in that side, because when you then start to see how good he's become, see him playing for the Brazilian national side and stuff, you think, wow, like that's who Leeds United have in their side. So I think I'd lean more into Rafinha, but I do think they're both good, and I'm not going to say anything negative just in case Liverpool people know where to find me on the internet. So anyway.
Well, I think Liverpool fans are saying, hopefully we won't have to sign these guys because they're all going to extend.
Exactly, yeah. But anyway, Atalanta will sign Jeremy Boga from Sassuolo for 22 million euros. Gab, does this make them title contenders?
I think they were title contenders before, even though, you know, obviously they've dropped points recently. I think Jeremy Boga is a phenomenal player in Serie A. I love the way he's come back from his injuries, from his difficulties. He's been phenomenal at Sassuolo. He's moving into a system for which he should be very much suited in terms of front three. I think this is a great signing. I think it's, at this stage, though, they need to move some guys out as well because they do have a lot of forwards. But yeah, I think Boga moves the needle. They're not favorites, but they'll be in the mix.
How do you sign a player for 22 million euros that's a really good player in 2021 or 2022? How's that possible? It seems exceptionally low.
I think, his contract, I think he's got 18 months left on his contract. I think that's part of it. And I think Boga's, obviously he's already had experiences in other countries and he's comfortable in Serie A. He sees Atalanta as, from what I'm told, he's a pretty educated guy. He sees Atalanta the kind of place where he can go get a lot of minutes, play in Europe, and maybe can be a springboard to somewhere else rather than perhaps, you know, going to Spurs and not starting, for example. I mentioned Spurs, but I'm not suggesting anything like
no,
Spurs.
No, you said it. It's out there. You said Spurs, everybody.
No, but if he means he goes to Spurs, he's Steven Bergwijn.
Yeah.
Right? He goes to Atalanta, similar system of play, whatever, and it's a different springboard, right? Yeah. I think that's what he's thinking. Edinson Cavani continues to be linked with a move away from Manchester United. There's been talk of Barcelona, yeah, because they couldn't find the money, yeah. but also Corinthians in Brazil. Nadim, it wouldn't really make sense for United to let both Martial and Cavani go in January, would it? Or is Rangnick just that out of the box?
It seems a bit wild to let those two go, even if it's for a case of backup. Because, you know, they obviously have Cristiano Ronaldo. But can they rest in? It's always the case of what happens if he gets injured. Does that mean United should just cancel the season, say everything's off? You know, you don't want to be in that sort of position. So I think it pays. I think they should try and keep those people on board. But like, you can't let them go in January, surely. Like, this is something that could happen in July. Definitely not January.
I also think Cavani's actually, despite of his age, he's quite well suited.
Probably suits the system,
to that system. You know, he's not going to be able to play, you know, midweek and then week at 90 minutes. But he can give you one game a week,
yes,
running his rear end off and bringing his size. He's a high-intensity
player with quality as well. And that suits their style. But, you know, we'll have to see how that goes. But anyway, Jose Mourinho hopes to secure a loan deal for Ainsley Maitland-Niles from Arsenal. Gab, is he what Roma need?
Well, if Mourinho thinks so, who am I to argue? No, just kidding. I think he is what they need because they're short in cover at wingback. Obviously, Spinazzola will be coming back eventually, but he's not back yet. On the left and on the right, they had Karsdorp, who's in and out. And they're short in central midfield. And those are the positions that Maitland-Niles can play. I'm told he sees himself as a central midfielder, doesn't want to play wing back. Well, he'll have the opportunity to impress Mourinho. Mourinho knows what he's getting, right? So if he banks on it, you know, you got to trust Mourinho.
What's the sense in Italy from sort of the market for English players now? Because it seems more now than it has been at any other time in my life, really.
I think as more teams play at a higher intensity and play more attacking football, especially with managers who've already been in the Premier League, like Conte, when obviously last season when he signed Ashley Young and Mourinho, I think there's a sense they can have an impact. But I think a lot of it depends on the person, on the personality.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Smalling, I'm sure he loved Manchester as much as you do. When he went to Rome, he completely embraced the city. And, you know, got the vegan thing going and the sunshine. And, you know, he's like the nature boy now. He fit straight in. But he also kept the other side of his game, the physicality and so on. He was very open to it. Other players move to Italy and don't really get it, you know. It depends. But when you have somebody like that, I think also Maitland-Niles could be just a useful addition for Mourinho because of his versatility mainly.
Yep.
Paris Saint-Germain have reportedly asked Kylian Mbappe to only decide his future after they play against Real Madrid in the Champions League. Nathan, there's obvious reasons behind this, but I also kind of feel like we in the media, when we put these reports out, we're being kind of stupid, right? I mean, if you were Mbappe, like, oh yeah, I'm going to wait until afterward. I mean,
he's decided his future already.
Yeah.
He's decided his future probably
a long
time ago.
So they're asking him to pretend you haven't decided.
Yeah, just don't say anything. Don't say anything till after this game. But, you know, for whatever the decision is from Mbappe, I'm sure he's going to be loyal to whatever shirt he's wearing at any particular moment.
Oh, he wants to win the Champions League.
Exactly. And that is the key thing there. So he can make that suggestion. But I'm sure they're not daft either. Like, he knows what he wants to do. Like, these players at the highest level now have an understanding of what they want to achieve. And it's just a case of whether they can find the leverage to be able to make that happen. And it seems like, for me, Mbappe's in a position where he does have that. So as a consequence, he knows what he wants and he's likely going to go and get it. But as for now, he's playing for PSG and he wants to win the Champions League, as you say. So it doesn't matter what somebody asks him to do. Doesn't make it so. Sticking with PSG, Rafinha could be on his way to Real Sociedad. Gab, does he move the needle for them?
Funny, there's a two Rafinha mentions, two different players, two very talented players. I think if he's fit, and he hasn't played much this year, but not just because of fitness, I think he completely does. I think he becomes very important, especially in terms of creativity, when David Silva isn't there. Mm-hmm. We've seen La Real always kind of go off the boil in the second half of the season. They've already gone off the boil a little bit. But this is a tremendous opportunity to finish in the top four this year. They're not going to challenge for the title, but with Barcelona behind, with Atleti struggling, I think it could be that little kick up the backside. And then all of a sudden, you know, if you've got Rafinha, David Silva, Oyarzabal, you know, the only living sore loss in captivity, and Alexander Isak, now we're talking. Now you've got options. It's, you know, I think it gives a little bit of depth to your squad. I think this would be a tremendous signing, and he's certainly highly motivated. And when he's fit, he's one of the most professional players you'll find out there. Neil Mopay scored for Brighton on Boxing Day, but did not celebrate against his old club, Brentford. Nadim, what's your take on players who do this?
My take? I think the fan in me is like, yeah, good. I'm glad he didn't. But the player in me is like, oh, you should absolutely do that, especially for a guy that gets criticized for not scoring enough goals. You need to be able to celebrate every single one of them.
He is a bit performative.
Well, you say that, but I'm sure if you were in his shoes, I reckon you'd celebrate. But anyway, let's go to this. So in Portugal, the Portuguese daily A Bola revealed the Porto employ a clairvoyant named Madalena Orozco, and they pay her, get ready for this, 150,000 euros a year to predict opposition lineups. Gabs, this sounds like money well spent to me.
It certainly is if it gets the results. She's actually good at it. I mean, look, in the end, it is useful, right? If you prepare for the opposition team, I don't care how she does. You can read tea leaves or whatever. Maybe it appears her in a dream. If it gets it done, well done to her. Right, we're almost done. However, I've been asked to read this holiday poem about Boxing Day. So bear with me. 'Twas a day after Christmas, and all through the league, there were positive tests and worry and even fatigue. Anfield and Molineux, but also Turf Moor, were empty and silent behind their closed door. Fans were aghast that these grounds were shuttered, making the poor fixture list all the more cluttered. Others tried in vain to have theirs postponed. Our gaffer, Patrick Vieira's positive, Palace intoned. But the powers that be were inflexible and firm, and Lucas Moura's performance made Palace squirm. Wilfred Zaha's two yellows before minute 45 were the nail in the coffin that sent Conte into overdrive. Yet Manchester City and Leicester were the talk of the day, and that was at the Etihad, nearly 200 miles away. Pep's strikerless ballet bombarded Casper's goal. Were he not a friendly ghost, he might have lost his soul. After 25 minutes, the score was 4-0, more than enough to break anyone's will. But maybe not these foxes, who already tasted a miracle. Madison, then Lookman, then Iheanacho, and it was lyrical. Guardiola looked up and saw it was 4-3. 25 minutes to go. Is that calamity staring at me? No, Pep, it's not. Because here's Laporte's header, and 6-3 from Sterling, who goes hell for leather. Out in East Anglia, Arsenal were hunting canaries. Pretty yellow birds, but hardly fitting adversaries. Arteta's men put 5 past a keeper named Gunn, whose afternoon, you'd imagine, was in no way fun. For the Gunners, the season started rather bumpy, but they're 4th in the table. No need to be grumpy, not least because Wenger would give a trophy for 4th, though these days Arsene into a FIFA man has morphed. And Tuchel, poor Thomas with his skeletal frame. It was Aston Villa way, not the simplest game. No Werner, no Havertz. Lukaku only fit enough for the bench. Pulisic the striker, the thirsts are goals he won't quench. But lucky for him, there's Jorginho from the spot. Not once, but twice, believe it or not. And big Lukaku, he was thrown into the fray, scored a goal, won a pen. That's 3 points away. West Ham, we know, once won the World Cup. But that was long ago, so Hammers, please shut up. Twice they came from behind against Southampton, with big Fraser Forster looking like a whale eating plankton. But there's a reason Ralf Hasenhüttl was once known as the Klopp of the Alps. He pushed on mercilessly and demanded Hammer scalps. Saints won 3-2, but now they're mid-table. And for Moyes, it's just a smudge in his redemption fable. The night closed with Brentford away to Brighton. Frank with his second balls, Potter here to enlighten. The goals took flight and won 2-0. And it was Neil Mopay, the former B, the prodigal hero. So football returns after a holiday excess. Something to distract, something over which to obsess. To entertain us and keep the Omicron at bay. Knowing United will make it forever go away. There you go. I don't need for a
pause. Bravo, bravo.
Right, that brings us to an end. I promise, no more poems. We're going to be back soon with Jules because we have midweek football and it just goes on. We'll catch you soon. And until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.